This is Audible.
Introduction. Listening to this book will dramatically improve your life. Got your attention, didn't I? Hopefully that hyped-up statement will prove to be true, although I fully realize there will be skeptics. After all, I've had 4 consecutive number one nonfiction bestsellers, so what is there left to say? I mean, come on, everybody knows O'Reilly is a champion bloviator, but is another book really necessary? I think so. You see, I've never really explained how I got to be that showy bloviator. I have not defined exactly how my opinions, which so rankle more than a few sensitive souls, were formed. So that's what this book is all about. Defining the experiences that have shaped my thinking, propelling me into becoming one of the most controversial human beings in the world. Also, I think you'll find the next few hours interesting on a number of other levels besides my life experience. This book is full of stories and references that perhaps were important in your life as well. By design, much of the story is about me, but not all about me. Thank God. We can't begin at the real beginning, September 10th, 1949, because not much was happening in my world at that time. I was just a normal baby, nothing unusual, no strange-looking eyes like those Village of the Damned kids. Wow, were they spooky or what? To this day, I remember those urchins scaring the milk duds out of me in a dark Long Island movie theater. No, my point of view really began taking shape at age 4, when, in a New York neighborhood teeming with children, playtime became an intense experience. A few years later, my intellectual development, such as it was, started to accelerate at a Catholic grammar school that was simply unforgettable. And it is at that school where this story begins. The year was 1957, the month September, and I had just turned 8 years old. Dwight Eisenhower was president, but in my life, it was the diminutive Sister Mary Lorana who ruled, at least in the third grade class where I was held captive. For reasons you will soon understand, my parents had remanded me to the penal institution of St. Bridget's School in Westbury, New York, a cruel and unusual punishment if there ever was one. Already, I had barely survived my first 2 years at St. Bridget's because I was, well, a little nitwit. Not satisfied with memorizing the Baltimore Catechism's fine prose, which featured passages like, God made me to show his goodness and to make me happy with him in heaven, I was constantly annoying my classmates and, of course, the no-nonsense Sister Lorana. With 60 overactive students in her class, she was understandably short on patience. For survival, she also had become very quick on the draw. Then it happened. One day I blurted out some dumb remark and Sister Lorana was on me like a panther. Her black habit blocked out all distractions as she leaned down, looked me in the eye, and uttered words I have never forgotten. William, you are a bold, fresh piece of humanity. And she was dead on. The next few hours will prove that the sister's perspicacious remark remains relevant about 50 years after the fact. But this account is not a traditional memoir in the sense that I mean to tell you about my life story. I don't want to do that, because I happen to think I'm a pretty boring guy. So, a recitation of my existence wouldn't do anyone much good. Instead, I will attempt to define why I believe what I believe, by telling you how those convictions grew directly out of my life experience. This tactic is designed to keep you, the listener, entertained and amused, as you and I probably have much in common, at least in the upbringing department. Once out of childhood, the adult, bold, fresh piece of humanity got around, visiting more than 70 countries, observing 4 wars up close and personal, meeting thousands of people, and having millions of laughs. So we'll take a look at some of that stuff in relation to important issues like war, peace, prosperity, and your daily life. Since millions of you listen to my bloviations on TV and radio, this book might provide some clarity, bonding, hate that word, and even some sympathy, although I don't seek it. Also, this audio program just might tee off some people even further. Either way, we'll have some fun. If you know my work, you might have figured out that I am not a philosopher or a dreamer. I do not live in a theoretical world or gain insights by attempting to read the thoughts of others. Instead, in line with the exhortations of Teddy Roosevelt, I embrace a strenuous life, My attitudes about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness have been formed by a multitude of unique occurrences that happened directly to me. Some of those events I will share with you, hoping that the sheer ego of the exercise will evaporate as you begin to understand how a doltish working-class kid from Levittown, Long Island, New York, has evolved into perhaps the most controversial journalist and commentator in the United States of America. I believe Sister Mary LaRana, who, by the way, is still alive and once sent me a very kind letter, is proud of me, although in truth the anguish I put her through can't ever be fully exorcised even by a William Peter Blatty character. But there is no doubt that the way I think today has its roots in my traditional childhood home and in the strict Catholic schools I attended. Therefore, we'll take an incisive look at those influences, as well as other significant events in the life of O'Reilly, all with an eye toward convincing you that the point of view I bring to the world is worthy and might even help you in your life. For starters, it really all did begin in the mid-1950s when America's population was half what it is today. Hope, as well as the challenge of swift change, was in the air. The USA had survived the Great Depression, World War II, and the Korean War. Despite saber-rattling by the Soviet Union, things were looking up, and everyday life was fairly simple, at least compared to today. You worked, obeyed the law, cared for your family, looked out for your neighbors, and respected your country. At least, that was the creed of the huge working class, which did most of the country's heavy lifting. That was the background of my family. My father, William O'Reilly Sr., had a decent job, bought a small house, and sired two kids. My mother, Ann O'Reilly, was an energetic stay-at-home mom because, had she not been, one of her kids would be in the penitentiary right now. Yes, that would be me. My younger sister, Janet, has always been a solid citizen, not at all fresh or bold. The nuns loved her. So that's the jumping-off point for this book, the white, ethnic, basically blue-collar suburbs of America in a conventional time when baby boomers were popping out all over the place. The journey begins at the dinner table, where chewy meatloaf and fish sticks reigned, and in a neighborhood full of kids playing in the streets, because our yards were too small. Oh, and one more thing. Hey, sister, I can't thank you enough for the title of this audiobook. Chapter 1, Politics. When they call the roll in the Senate, the senators do not know whether to answer present or not guilty. Theodore Roosevelt. If you watch the bold, fresh guy on television or listen to me on the radio, you know I'm not a rabidly partisan political guy. I don't endorse candidates for office or shill for them in any way. Party affiliation doesn't matter to me. Over the years, my philosophy has evolved into this. I'd vote for the person who I believe will do the least amount of damage to the country. It is rare that a true problem solver is nominated for office, so usually it's who will do the least amount of harm to the folks. I know that sounds cynical, but let's be honest. Politics in America is a money play full of charlatans and crazed ideologues. Once in a while, a person of true principle emerges, but the media usually quickly destroys that candidate because honesty always, and I mean always, collides with ideology. Only independent thinkers can deliver unbiased appraisals of complicated problems, and independent thinkers have little chance to succeed in our two-party system, which demands rigid adherence to left or right doctrine. My philosophy about what's best for America is spelled out in vivid detail in my last book, Culture Warrior, so there's no need to state it again. However, no matter what I say or write, fanatics will attack it because Kool-Aid-drinking ideologues on both sides resent my national platform and non-aligned analysis. I'm amused that the far left attempts to demonize me as a rigid conservative, while at the same time, the far right despises me because I'm not reactionary enough. As I always say, as long as the extremists hate me, I know I'm doing my job. So bring it on, Sean Penn and Michael Savage. You guys are totally nuts. It's a compliment that both of you attack my work. The political angst that I now proudly cause began rather early in my life. Thinking back, I realized my first brush with politics happened in 1956 when I heard my mother sing, "I like Ike, I'll say it again and again, I like Ike, let him finish the job he began." Since I was just 6 years old, I didn't like Ike because I didn't know who he was. I did know Buffalo Bob and Mighty Mouse, Davy Crockett and Elvis, but not this guy, Ike. Both of my parents were traditional people in most ways, but were also politically independent. Because the O'Reilly clan comprised mainly civil servants working in New York City, they were loyal Democrats. On my mother's side, the Kennedys and the Drakes usually voted Democrat as well. But the Democrat running against President Eisenhower, Adlai Stevenson, was an avowed social liberal and held zero appeal for my parents, who believed strongly in self-reliance and Judeo-Christian values. Stevenson would say that year, "Trust the people, trust their good sense." Well, old Adelaide shouldn't have been shocked that my folks and most others living in Levittown did not trust him. Overwhelmingly, they voted for Ike. One of the reasons was his service. My father was a naval officer during World War II and respected Dwight Eisenhower's performance in the European theater. Back then, and still today, traditional people supported the military. Ike won a second term in a landslide. To me, a fresh but also shallow little kid, politics was really boring. Outside of the St. Bridget's classroom, my childhood was largely one big game. I played four sports: football, baseball, basketball, and ice hockey. When games weren't scheduled, we played stickball in the street. Cheap game. All you needed was a rubber ball and a broomstick. We also played keep away and ring-o-leave-o. Don't even ask. We were sweating all the time and had zero interest in public policy. For us, the Cold War took place on a hockey pond in mid-January. Forced into the arena. Then, in 1960, John F. Kennedy ran for president against Vice President Richard Nixon. Suddenly, there was a split in my house. My mother, a Kennedy on her mom's side, was a JFK supporter. My father went with Nixon even though he didn't like the man all that much. I don't remember exactly why my parents supported their respective candidates, but I do recall sitting at the supper table, we never called it dinner, and hearing them tease each other. My mother said they were going to cancel each other out. I didn't know what that meant and didn't really care. My mom's cooking was so awful, I just wanted to get away from the table as fast as possible. As the election approached, my sixth grade teacher, a kindly old woman named Mrs. Boyle, came up with an idea. The class should have a debate. And since I never shut up, I was chosen to be one of the debaters. This was not good. I had no idea what a debate was, much less whom I should support. Giants versus Yankees, I knew. Kennedy against Nixon, total blank. "So William," Mrs. Boyle said, "which candidate will you support? Is Davy Crockett running?" Yes, I actually said that stupid thing. But Mrs. Boyle was used to my nonsense, and so was the class, which considered me a hopeless buffoon. Since I had only two choices, I took Nixon because my father was louder than my mother. It's true, that was my sole rationale. Republicans and Democrats didn't even enter into my thinking. Because my dad bloviated more about stuff than my mom, I figured he'd be happy to give me some debating tips. Forget it. My father, all 6'4", 210 pounds of him, lumbered home from work every day around 6:30 p.m., exactly 12 hours from the time he left for the office in the morning. His job as a money changer for an oil company was boring, and as stated, my mother's culinary skills were, well, incredibly bad. So in addition to being exhausted by dull and tedious work, my father was usually hungry. This is not a good combination for a big Irish guy with a temper. Typically, my sister and I avoided Dad until about noon on Saturday. He cooked breakfast on the weekends, which put him in a better frame of mind. My father's cooking was far superior to my mom's, and she knew it, but she didn't really care. I'm telling you all this because my plan was to have my father write down what I should say about Richard Nixon to tell me why the guy was the greatest. In that way, I could memorize my father's point of view and dazzle Mrs. Boyle in the class with the wisdom of my dad, which, of course, I would claim as my own. I mean, how great was this strategy? So, on the eve of the big debate, with pen and paper in hand, I asked my father why he was voting for Nixon. Sitting on the floor, I was poised to write down every single word. "Because Kennedy's father is a crook," my dad said. "Really, a crook?" I asked. "Yep." "In what way?" "Sold booze during Prohibition." "Oh." I didn't exactly know what Prohibition was, but It sounded good, so I wrote it down, badly misspelling the P word. Still, I needed more, or it would be a short debate, so I pressed on. What about Nixon? Why do you like him? Don't like him, my father answered. You don't like him? Almost immediately, I was panicking. They're all phonies, my father said, and went back to watching the Ed Sullivan Show. I remember scribbling in my notebook, Kennedy's dad is a crook, sold booze, pro-something, my dad hates Nixon. They're all phonies. A vague sense of doom gripped me. But what could I do? My father had spoken and was not a man you badgered for anything. The next day, Monday, Mrs. Boyle announced that the debate would be held after the lunch recess. On my side were two other young Republicans. On the other side, three Democrats. All I remember about the ensuing fiasco is that I said something about Nixon being tough on the Russians and Kennedy's father being a crook. The other side totally ignored me and hammered home just one emphatic point. John Fitzgerald Kennedy was Catholic. They won the debate by a landslide. Fine with me. That debating business was far too much work. Back then, if anyone had ever suggested that I eventually would become famous for debating on television, Mrs. Boyle would have called the mental health authorities to take a close look at the child who had suggested it. After the election, the new Kennedy administration impacted me only because of the fallout shelter drills at school. Once in a while, a bell rang and all the St. Bridget's kids had to file out to the school parking lot, where, we were told, if a random atom bomb happened to fall nearby, buses would whisk us away to some underground bunker. Nobody seemed very concerned about it, but a few years later, the Cuban Missile Crisis did get the attention of the smarter kids. But obviously, I was not one of the smarter kids. American Bandstand had more influence on me than President Kennedy or any other politician. In fact, about the only time I locked in on Kennedy was when comedian Vaughn Mader did a dead-on impression of him on TV. There was also a song called My Daddy is President by a kid trying to imitate Caroline Kennedy, the president's young daughter. I remember thinking the song was stupid, which is somewhat incomprehensible, since I liked a Christmas song recorded by singers imitating chipmunks. It was that kind of taste and logic that defined me as a child. The end of innocence. The political thing became more focused for me on November 22, 1963, when the loudspeaker in Brother Carmine Diodati's religion class crackled and on came a report of President Kennedy's assassination in Dallas. By then, I was a freshman at Chaminade High School, and this was big Kennedy territory. The following days featured a number of sorrowful masses and lectures about the slain president and the tragedy that had befallen America. At home, my parents never said much about the murder itself, but were glued to Walter Cronkite for information. I remember that my father didn't much care for Lyndon Johnson, who was distant to him in many ways. My mother was mostly worried about Jackie Kennedy and her two young children. But all in all, politics and the issues of the day did not intrude very much on the O'Reilly family situation. We soldiered on, so to speak, without much partisan activity. It was the same thing on the street. I can never remember my friends discussing politics at all. Why would you? We had the Yankees, Mets, Giants, Jets, Rangers, and Knicks. It was exhausting. Then came the summer of 1967, the summer of love in San Francisco. For us teenagers in my Levittown neighborhood, love was often demonstrated in cars on dark lanes. But as Bob Dylan sang, the times were a-changing. Vietnam began heating up, and a few of the older guys came home injured from Southeast Asia. Some others showed up with completely altered personalities. For the first time in my life, I saw close up what war could do. Curious, I talked with some of the returning vets, and they all said the same thing. Vietnam was chaos. There was nothing good about it. That fall, I entered Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York, exempt from the draft on a student deferment. Most of the neighborhood guys who did not have that advantage were called up and many shipped out to Southeast Asia. One neighborhood guy came home from Vietnam and killed himself. Another became a hardcore drug addict. Like everyone else, I saw the fighting on television and heard the intense debates. So I decided to ask my father about it. He said the war was a disaster, nothing like World War II, when the country was united against enemies that had directly attacked us. He didn't further explain his opinion, but his blunt words overrode everything else on the subject as far as I was concerned. My father was a tough guy, sometimes irrational in his anger over petty stuff, but he never lied to me, and he was not uninformed. If he thought the Vietnam situation was screwed up, it was screwed up. As opposition to the war mounted throughout the country, I paid more attention, but typically I was essentially detached from most of it. Playing football for Marist College, socializing, and occasionally studying occupied most of my time. Even though not pro-war, my father and many other Levittowners were rapidly becoming appalled by the often outlandish behavior displayed by hardcore anti-war activists. Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, and the rest of the militant protesters brought a few choice words from Second Lieutenant William O'Reilly Sr. As a former naval officer, he didn't like drugs, he didn't like sloppy appearances, and he didn't like the pounding music from Iron Butterfly. He wasn't overly angry with the yippies and hippies. He was more confused by them. What had happened to America? I rarely discussed the state of the country with my father during my summers at home because we were both working long hours. He was still a low-level bean counter, and I made money as a swimming instructor for the town of Babylon on Long Island. One night, however, I did play him a cut from the new Doors album. I can't remember why I did such an inexplicable thing, but I do clearly recall his terse response, "Stick with Elvis." Okay. At the same time, my father recoiled from the America right or wrong crowd. He wanted effective leadership in Washington, not fatuous propaganda. As the war foundered, his opinion of President Johnson and the Democratic establishment cratered. And without viable options in the campaign of 1968, my father was forced again to support Richard Nixon for president. As they say in Mad Magazine, yeesh. Meantime, my college career was going the way that most college careers go. I did my work, tried and failed to beguile young ladies, and had a load of mindless fun without getting loaded. Well, I might be a bit unusual in the last category. You'll get a more thorough explanation later. Also, because I had begun writing for the college newspaper, I started paying closer attention to world events, which were growing more chaotic by the week, both at home and abroad. Still, at Marist College, the anti-war movement was rather placid, because most of the students were sons and daughters of working people, cops, firemen, salesmen, and the like. Those folks were not real enthusiastic about chanting, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" Trust me, few were burning flags and/or bras in Levittown. Till it's over there. In the spring of 1969, a life-altering thing happened. Some of my college friends were accepted to the third-year abroad program and suggested I apply as well. I didn't jump at the prospect right away because I was playing football, writing for the paper, and had figured out how to get relatively good grades for the least amount of work. I wasn't all that intrigued with the prospect of going to a foreign country where I might actually have to bust my butt academically and give up football. But finally, I decided to apply. I was turned down. Outrage gripped me. Turned down? Are you kidding me? My grades were better than most of those accepted, and I even spent more than an hour writing the damn third-year abroad essay, explaining my desire to accelerate my knowledge. Of course, it was complete BS, but so were all the other essays. What the heck was going on? The answer to that question takes us back to my experience in grammar school. Remember when I was labeled a bold, fresh piece of humanity? The problem, according to some Marist teachers, was that I was still simply that. In the eyes of my instructors, I had not evolved very much from the little wise guy that Sister Lorana had accurately branded. In short, I was a Philistine who could not be trusted to represent the college in a sophisticated foreign country or any other destination for that matter. Oh, yeah? Now, I'm the type of guy who does not readily accept the word no. I've succeeded in my career because the more negative things said about me, the harder I work to disprove them. Living well is not the best revenge. Succeeding in your career and humiliating your critics is. Anyway, I demanded that the professors running the abroad program explain themselves, or I would write an article accusing them of anti-Irish bias, or anti-Levittown bias, or whatever bias I could conjure up. In a tense meeting, I explained to those pinheads that I studied hard, had achieved a high grade point average, had avoided any misdemeanor or felony convictions, and actually attended church most every Sunday. So what say you, professors? They folded. I was accepted into the program. The problem was, I didn't actually want to go abroad. But I had caused such a ruckus that, in September 1969, I found myself on an ocean liner sailing from New York City to Southampton, England. Accompanying me were hundreds of other students, many of whom were long-haired, pot-fueled male maniacs who did far better with the female passengers than I did. Plus, I got seasick. Not good at all. When I arrived in London to begin my courses at Queen Mary College, a satellite of the University of London, I immediately ran into a lot of anti-American feeling. The Vietnam War, of course, was just as unpopular in Great Britain as it was in the USA. But there was also an undercurrent of hostility toward the American system in general. In my student dormitory, Commonwealth Hall, some of the blokes actually disliked me solely because of my citizenship. Certainly, we can all understand loathing me because of my personality issues, but embracing hate simply because I was born in the USA? Completely unacceptable. One guy named Derek consistently gave me a hard time about my New York accent. It was clear to him that everything in British culture was far superior to anything America had to offer. I found this kind of thing amusing, since the highest-rated TV program in England in 1969 was Top of the Pops, a ripoff of American Bandstand. And for much of that year, the highest-rated song on that program was a ditty by a group called Edison Lighthouse that featured this perceptive chorus. Love grows where my rosemary goes, and nobody knows like me. As the British are fond of saying, indeed. Anyway, I annoyed Derek by mocking the Pops, and he continued on me about my speech patterns until I let loose with this bit of intellectual wisdom. Hey, bud, you'd have a German accent if it wasn't for my father and thousands of other New Yorkers like him. So blank you, fish and chips, and the Beatles. Got it? Make friends everywhere. That's always been my motto. Somewhere in Poughkeepsie, the head of the third year abroad program was weeping. The anti-Americanism I witnessed in the dorm, during anti-war demonstrations in Trafalgar Square, in the British classrooms, and on the BBC, did not go down real well with me. I was no fan of the Vietnam War, but even at 19 years old, I loved my country and understood its essential nobility. America is not a perfect place, but the good heavily outweighs the bad, and those who despise us around the world are misguided and often teamy off. So, the origin of my intense feelings for the USA can be charted back to those intense days in London. Throughout my year over there, I gave it to the American haters good, often using a very loud New York accent to do my debating. Blimey. To this day, I believe much of the anti-Americanism in Europe is driven by simple jealousy. America is a big, loud dog that generally struts its stuff. Many folks, even in the United States, do not like that kind of presentation. Overseas, some people form shallow, negative judgments about the USA without understanding or even looking at the overall picture. Throughout our history, Americans have freed hundreds of millions of people all over the world. Yet a 2007 Pew Research poll, to use one example, found that the majority of British subjects have an unfavorable view of America. Even fueled by Guinness, that is a tough one to swallow. About 2 months into my first semester in London, I got a bit bored with the rain and decided to see the rest of Europe. I bought a small motorcycle and set off. Before I was through, I had cut scores of classes, but visited Ireland, Spain, Portugal, Morocco, France, Italy, Switzerland, Germany, Belgium, Holland, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Austria, not to mention Andorra, Liechtenstein, Luxembourg, and San Marino. What an education. Back then, the only continental country where I sensed a strong anti-American feeling was France, but I quickly learned that the French didn't like anyone. There's a story about President Johnson being so fed up with the anti-Americanism of Charles de Gaulle that he called the French president and threatened to exhume every American body buried in Normandy and ship the corpses back to the USA. I believe that story is true. But some attitudes notwithstanding, traveling around Europe was a blast. As a history major, I couldn't get enough of it. From the Rhine castles to the Swiss Alps to the French Riviera, each destination was thrilling to a hometown guy like me, whose family vacation history was spelled Vermont. However, I did compare all the places I visited with home. And guess what? Home always won. Some will call it chauvinism, but for me, the USA simply worked better. The socialism I saw in Northern Europe sapped initiative and limited achievement. The fascism I saw in Franco's Spain was downright nasty. One of Franco's Guardia Civil goons actually awakened me on a train in the middle of the night by tapping my leg with a machine gun. My infraction? My foot was resting on the empty seat across from me. Arriving in Germany, I found the communist wall dividing the country to be offensive and depressing. From my safe haven across the divide, I actually gave an East German guard the finger, something I rarely do. So, I got to see a lot of overseas stuff up close and personal, and all of it confirmed that the land of the free and the home of the brave was the perfect place for a working-class kid like me. When I visited Vatican City, I lit a candle in St. Peter's, thanking God I was born an American, and I believe many Italians would echo that sentiment. Since my first adventure abroad, I have traveled extensively, visiting more than 70 countries. And always upon my return, when the U.S. customs guy says, "Welcome home," I get a chill every time. Get back home, Loretta. Coming back to the USA to finish college in the fall of 1970 was something of a shock. The killing of four Kent State students by National Guardsmen in May of that year had radicalized millions more Americans against the war and the government. To my amazement, even the atmosphere at traditionalist Marist College had completely changed. When I left for England, Marist was primarily a beer-drinking school. But in 1 year, that image had evaporated. Pot, hashish, and LSD had replaced the kegs. Some of my friends who had haircuts like Dennis the Menace when I left now looked like one of the Kinks, British rock group, grooming challenged. Pampered white kids from Scarsdale were quoting Huey Newton, the Minister of Defense for the Black Panthers. As they said back then, far out. For me, a budding independent thinker, most of this stuff was nonsense. Huey Newton, please. Power to the people, sure. Jane Fonda for Secretary of State and Jimi Hendrix for President. About the only thing I found fundamentally interesting in the age of Aquarius was the change in attitude among many young women. See, sexual politics had hit Marist College hard. In the space of 1 year, sleeping with someone had gone from a fairly serious decision to, if it feels good, do it. Of course, that philosophy, when it comes to substances, can easily lead to rehab or to the morgue, as Joplin, Hendrix, Morrison, and scores of others would amply demonstrate. But back in the fall of 1970, drug and dating protocols were evolving, and it was fascinating to watch. Scrawny, unkempt guys who were lepers to the opposite sex just 12 months prior were now making out very well, especially if they spouted radical rubbish and had a stash of weed. To me, it was madness. To the nebbishes, it was heaven on earth. Very simply, I was able to keep rather than feed my head because I did not do drugs. Again, we'll explore that later. I refused to join Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. I lost out on some, social gratification for my stance, but I'm very glad I held the line. Also, I was busy enough with writing and football to avoid most heavy conversations. That's BS in today's lexicon. But I couldn't avoid the loud, pulsating cream and vanilla fudge music, or the clouds of pot smoke on my dormitory floor. That was really annoying. So although the mood on campus had turned far left, I couldn't dig it. I wasn't conservative, but I wasn't grooving to the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, either. Basically, I stayed out of the fray. I was back on the football team, writing for the paper, and counting the days until graduation. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young were asking me, what if you knew her and found her dead on the ground? But, perhaps selfishly, I was holding back on any answer. In fact, the entire anti-war thing was numbing. Every day, the same chant, the same rant. The only entertaining political thing that happened was Elvis visiting Nixon at the White House. On December 21st, 1970, the king showed up on Pennsylvania Avenue looking like he had just partied with Willie Nelson. Nixon posed for a picture with the E-man, seemingly oblivious to the king's state of mind. I have that famous picture hanging on my office wall to this day. But the gruesome hits just kept on coming. In the spring of 1971, Lieutenant William Calley was convicted of premeditated murder in the killings of 22 Vietnamese civilians at My Lai, effectively removing any semblance of the moral high ground from the American military effort. The world was seething at the United States, and things at Maris were getting out of control as well, with boycotts and demonstrations and sit-ins. Remember, this was regular people Poughkeepsie, New York, not pseudo-intellectual Cambridge, Massachusetts. I couldn't keep up with the outrage du jour, and didn't even try. I felt terrible for our troops in Vietnam, because some of them were my friends, and I knew they were good people. I understood that Calley was a criminal. I also knew that he did not represent the vast majority of the American military. But my point of view was drowned out by the fierce anti-war frenzy on display everywhere. Slowly, I grew to detest the excess and arrogance displayed by some of those anti-war people. I speak from direct experience. One fine spring day, I was walking across campus, heading for my French history class. Now, this course was not exactly a blast, but the professor, Peter O'Keefe, was a smart guy and aimed to present the material in a relevant way. So I showed up twice a week and tried to learn something about European history. As I approached the classroom building, a long-haired guy, badly in need of shampoo and conditioner, blocked my way. "Nobody's going to class today," he said. "We're having a solidarity meeting." "Enjoy it, bud," I shot back. "I'll see you over there." "You can't go to class," the student insisted.
"I can't?"
"That's right, man. You can't." Now, I hate to admit this because I don't relish physical confrontation, but I grabbed the guy, tossed him in some bushes, and proceeded along to my class. He weighed about 80 pounds, so it wasn't exactly world wrestling entertainment underway. However, the altercation left me more than a little steamed. There's a line you don't cross with me, and this mini-militant had crossed that line. It was my first brush with left-wing totalitarianism. There would be many more to come. That day, only 4 students showed up for class. The rest knew they had a valid excuse for cutting. Professor O'Keefe discussed the situation with us, putting forth the view that the dissenters, the anti-war movement, brooked no dissent themselves. They had morphed into bitter anti-American automatons whose actions were far more destructive than constructive. I found that analysis interesting and generally on the mark. Although I have to say that there were some very sincere anti-war people who did not despise their country and truly wanted peace for all. The power of the people crowd, however, generally overwhelmed those voices. The rest of the semester played out peacefully enough, and in May I graduated with honors, but still with little interest in politics. I followed the subsequent Vietnam peace talks, read the paper, and watched a little TV news, but for me, sports and friends still dominated my life. As the war was winding down, I was looking ahead. Luckily, I got a job as a high school teacher in a poor suburb of Miami, Florida, and dialed into building a worthwhile life for myself in a country that allowed me to do so. Some of my college friends continued chasing Grace Slick's White Rabbit, but not me. I wanted to do something good, and teaching seemed to be the pathway. Politics, however, still hovered over my head a bit. As a history major, I was assigned to teach a course called Contemporary Problems, which would involve analysis of current events. In choosing the course readings, I decided to introduce both sides of the arguments and encourage students to think independently, not parrot the views of their parents or peers. The class worked and quickly became one of the most popular at Monsignor Edward Pace High School. Far from the left-wing indoctrination that dominated college campuses, my course examined the obvious problems in America, but always with a respectful overview that acknowledged the historical greatness of our country. To this day, I have not deviated from that approach, and I believe it is a key to my success. Independent thinking leads to problem solving, fairness, compassion, and wisdom. Putting that discipline into practice helps me decide exactly where I stand on many subjects. Rejecting the so-called popular wisdom leads me to research my opinions and accumulate facts to back them up. In contrast, Kool-Aid drinking ideology, whether left or right, usually leads to narrow-mindedness, robotic acceptance of propaganda, and eventually embarrassment when the party line collapses, as it inevitably will in some cases. No ideology is correct on every issue. So I'm real comfortable in a zone of independence. There, my traditional beliefs are accepted, and I serve no political master. I may be bold and fresh with this attitude, but I'm also free to see both sides of complicated situations and embrace solutions wherever I can find them. It's a nice place to be. Chapter 2, Self-Reliance. You've been told, so maybe it's time that you learned. Eric Clapton, I Can't Stand It. One of the worst sights ever seen in America was the mass panic in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005. You remember the scenes, thousands of people jumbled together in the dark, smelly Superdome without adequate food, water, or restroom facilities. Families pleading for help from rooftops as muddy floodwaters rose, threatening their lives. Then, as the days dragged on, hundreds of exhausted survivors waiting under a scorching sun to be evacuated from highway overpasses. This was America? All over the world, folks were shocked when these awful scenes were broadcast on TV. We expect to see these kinds of scenarios in third world countries, but not from the richest, most technologically advanced nation on the planet. How could this happen in the land of plenty? Where was the swift, effective assistance that many Americans expected? Almost immediately after Katrina hit, the ideologues sprang into action. It was racial, the skin color hustlers wailed. Most of those stranded were black and poor. America and George Bush don't care about them. Rapper Kanye West actually said that at a public appearance. Later, comedian Chris Rock told the political fundraiser audience that Bush couldn't get to the California fires fast enough because white people were burning. But the president had no time for the poor blacks in New Orleans. Rock then went on to say, Bush used Katrina water to douse the California flames. Not to be outdone by a rapper and a comedian, left-wing loons in the media like New York Times columnist Paul Krugman blame most of the Katrina misery on Mr. Bush. Over the years, the prevailing wisdom from the Times crew has been that Bush loathes the poor and wants to see them suffer. Thus, Bush stood by willfully as the New Orleans disaster unfolded. Here's part of what Krugman wrote, quote, "The federal government's lethal ineptitude wasn't just a consequence of Mr. Bush's personal inadequacy. It was a consequence of ideological hostility to the very idea of using government to serve the public good," unquote. But the hysteria party was just getting started. Film director Spike Lee then offered an opinion that the levees in New Orleans might have been intentionally sabotaged to harm poor people of color. Amidst all this insanity, my take on the Katrina aftermath was pithy and blunt. Certainly, some innocent poor people received cruel blows, and every American should have been sympathetic to their plight. And many of us were, as billions of charitable dollars flowed into the hurricane zone. But there was another huge factor in play as well. A few days after the storm hit, I said this on television, quote, "There is no question the Bush administration was slow in getting relief to the hurricane zone. That's legitimate criticism. But the truth is this. Governor Blanco of Louisiana did not have a disaster plan in place, did not have enough state police and National Guard to secure a city the size of New Orleans, and did not push for federal help soon enough. New Orleans is not about race, it's about class. If you're poor, you're powerless, not only in America, but also everywhere on Earth. If you don't have enough money to protect yourself from danger, danger is going to find you. And all the political gibberish in the world is not going to change that. The aftermath of Hurricane Katrina should be taught in every American school. If you don't get educated, if you don't develop a skill and force yourself to work hard, you'll most likely be poor. And sooner or later, you'll be standing on a symbolic rooftop waiting for help. Chances are that help will not be quick in coming." Unquote. In my opinion, that was one of my best TV commentaries ever. But after I delivered it, the far-left internet smear sites went into spasms of indignation, rolling out headlines like, "O'Reilly blames the poor for the Katrina disaster." Syndicated columnist Liz Smith picked up on the chatter and wrote, quote, Fox News emperor Bill O'Reilly tells us in Katrina's wake that if we Americans depend on the United States government for any reason, we're certain to be disappointed. Bill's advice to America, to the poor of New Orleans especially, is to educate yourself and get a well-paying job. Only then can you avoid standing on a metaphorical rooftop when the next disaster rolls around. Bill did not give the poor any advice on how one finds a proper education or a job. Remember, the government can't help, unquote. Now, I like Liz Smith. She's a self-proclaimed liberal but a fair-minded person who does a lot of good for other people. But come on, Liz, are there no schools where you live? You don't find a proper education, you work for one. Yeah, some schools, especially in the poor precincts, are inadequate despite record federal spending. But there are kids in those schools who excel. And once children achieve a decent education, chances are they'll join the vast majority of Americans who have been able to secure a decent job. So let's do the math. Each year, some 10 million or more illegal alien workers are able to earn billions of dollars in the U.S. economy and send much of that money to their families back home. So, what's the lesson here? It's simple. I believe almost every American can prosper if he or she does what is absolutely necessary. That is, learn a skill, work hard. If that mantra were drummed into America's children, this country would be a far better place. But don't tell that to the far left. Liberal thought at times allows for people to avoid taking responsibility for their lives. If someone fails to do the basics in order to succeed, it's not really their fault, you see. It's a callous society or the evil Bush administration that has held them back. Liberal thought is very clear. The government has an obligation to make sure all 300 million Americans, plus millions of illegal immigrants, have everything they need to get by. That, of course, is unworkable nonsense, a kind of quasi-socialism that, if embraced by an individual, will lead to disaster. America is a capitalist nation, a place of intense competition. You have a better chance of dating Britney Spears than you have of the feds making sure your life is working out. The Katrina debacle really disturbed me. I couldn't stop thinking about it. Since I wanted my analysis of the situation to really mean something, I began to investigate and talk to some of the folks who did not evacuate New Orleans ahead of the storm. Most admitted they ignored the repeated warnings. Some said they had no money for a bus ticket out of town. Others told me they had nowhere to go, no family or friends outside the Big Easy. Even though I found those admissions startling, I believed them. But again, here's the lesson. If you have no money, no support system, no common sense, and no motivation to provide security for yourself and your family, you're gonna get hammered. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. That said, there's no question but that the local, state, and federal governments screwed up after Katrina hit. Are you surprised? If you are, say hello to the Tin Man for me, because you're definitely living in the land of Oz. And when that house fell on the Wicked Witch after the tornado, did FEMA show up to help her? No, it did not. And Dorothy looted her ruby slippers. So, wise up fast, or you'll lose your shoes, too. Despite their impassioned rhetoric, the lefty pointy heads at Harvard and in the media cannot help you. When an administration promises that it will elevate your life and protect you on a personal level, you're being conned. The feds are good at collecting taxes and organizing the military. Aside from that, Washington is very limited in what it can actually achieve. Bottom line, if you don't have loyal friends and family, you're on your own. Read it, learn it, live it, as the guy in Fast Times at Ridgemont High once said. Wise up fast. Looking back, the reason that I have succeeded in my life is that I relied on myself, not on some mythical theory about government. If I had lived in New Orleans, I would have gotten in my car and driven the hell out of there as soon as the National Weather Service gave warning. At no time would I have considered counting on Big Easy Mayor Ray Nagin for anything. The man can barely figure out the lock on his office door. Same thing with Governor Kathleen Blanco and President Bush. I'm not counting on them for anything. Call me cynical. Now, I really do feel sorry for the folks who did not or could not leave New Orleans. Using the resources of my program, we were able to get some of them evacuated and perhaps saved a few lives. I also said prayers for them. But there are Americans right now in the same spot as the hurricane victims were. They are either too dumb, too lazy, too mentally challenged, or too unlucky to have provided themselves with basic protections. So this chapter is dedicated to those who have little control over what happens to them in life. Hey, you guys, you can turn it around. Listen up. Even when I was just 5 years old, I had to be somewhat self-reliant. That's because I attended Miss Dalton's kindergarten class at Bowling Green Public School. Basically, this campus was a free-for-all where we urchins ran wild. My friend Jimmy Cunningham and I, both junior hooligans, spent the days building things with blocks and then gleefully knocking them down. We were training to be Teamsters, and we didn't even know it. I'm surprised I didn't get a tattoo. My point is that the teacher, Miss Dalton, exerted little control in the classroom and absolutely none on the playground. Routinely, kids wiped out on the steel monkey bars and smashed their small skulls on the concrete below. I mean, it was survival of the fittest in every sense. There were no play dates, bicycle helmets, or organized activities. It was demolition derby every day, and the kid with the most bruises won. Miss Dalton, with her mousy brown hair and thick glasses, wasn't much of a factor, so to speak. She was around, the pictures prove it, but there were few, what I call Barney, moments. In fact, had a singing purple dinosaur actually been introduced into the kindergarten fray back then, things might have turned ugly. That kind of kid environment shapes you. Think about a 5-year-old pioneer kid back in the 19th century. No play dates for him, no sir. He's too busy shooting bears and watching for roaming Apaches. Back then, a male child became a man at age 13, and that was that. The young guy had to learn not only to survive, but also to protect his family. Nobody was waiting for President Grant to help out. How things have changed. Today, the loony left is peddling the nanny state, and millions of Americans are buying the idea. How ridiculous. How dangerous. It was quite the opposite when I was growing up in the huge, sprawling suburb of Levittown. There, self-reliance was a must. With literally hundreds of kids wandering around looking for action, conflict was everywhere. Everyday rank-out sessions took place. These verbal jousts were designed to diminish your opponent's self-esteem. My favorite put-down was, "Your mother wears combat boots." What the heck does that mean, anyway? Nobody quite knew. But it was big. And if you let loose with a rank-out, fists were likely to fly. In Levittown, moms were sacred. There may not have been combat boots, but there was certainly combat itself. And God help any boy who ran home to mom or dad for assistance or sympathy. He immediately became a leper. I mean, there were serious consequences for getting Ozzie or Harriet involved in your conflicts. The kids generally settled stuff themselves. Nobody had money for a lawyer. Not that any parent wanted to get dragged into that stuff. My father's orders, and I can still hear him bellowing, were to come home when the streetlights came on and don't take any garbage from your idiot friends. That was it, and he didn't want to hear about the gory details. My father could not have cared less what went on in Toyland. That's not to say that everybody in my neighborhood turned out to be self-reliant. They did not. My earliest friends were Johnny, Charlie, and Larry. Names are changed. We started playing together at 4 years old. Eventually, two of them grew up to become drug addicts. Johnny actually died from AIDS in his early 40s, breaking his mother's heart. Larry signed up for Scientology. So, early reliance on self is not an indicator of a happy life. But for me, the school of hard knocks worked. Never did I expect the troops to rush to my rescue. I fought my own battles, won more than I lost, and developed a cocky attitude that continues to serve me well. When I wanted money, I worked for it. If I wanted to play football, I organized the game. Life was simple. You want it, make it happen. Somebody bothers you, deal with it. Watch and learn. There was another reason that self-reliance showed up early in my life, my father's job. Over the years, I watched my dad surrender his dignity to the Caltex Oil Company. He knew that his mundane accounting job did not challenge his potential. He told me so on his deathbed. After a while, the slow drip, drip, drip of daily boredom drove my father kind of crazy. Every day, he would get up and go to a job he hated. Imagine living that kind of life. My father did not seek a better alternative because, frankly, he was scared. We'll deal with fear in the next chapter. Being raised during the Great Depression, when jobs were scarce and despair was in the air, caused him and many others to believe that economic doom was always hiding in the closet just waiting to pounce. So as long as his meager paycheck kept coming, my father toughed it out and did not look for something better. Now, some of my father's superiors at Caltech sensed his weakness and, as a result, treated him badly, which, of course, was hard to swallow for a guy like him. Eventually, the frustration he felt affected his health. Still, he did not take action. Year after year passed without advancement. Tragically, he depended on a corporate giant that could not have cared less about him. Finally, after 35 years, Caltech gave him a cheap watch and a small pension. See ya. After watching that situation up close and personal, no way was I ever going to rely on any company, government, or person. I was your standard-issue dopey kid, but I absorbed one thing. I was going to make money and forge a career on my own terms. No fear. I would continue being a bold, fresh piece of humanity and blank anyone who didn't like it. One of the great things about America is that we are all allowed to fall flat on our faces, as Vince Lombardi pointed out, but then get back up and try again. I believe that this is the key that turns the good life lock. My father had a college education and did work hard, but many times that is not enough. My dad never took a chance. Like the New Orleans people who refused to move in the face of a vicious oncoming storm, my father hunkered down and got clobbered. No one came to help. If there is only one thing that you take from this book, let it be this. Design your own life. Never give up trying to make it on your own. Get back up when you get slapped down and don't waste time buying into ideological nonsense. Expect and accept nothing from anyone else. Do it yourself. And after you have succeeded, share some of what you've achieved with those not as strong as you will become. That's important. Spread the self-reliance message, but also help good people when they need a hand. Once in a while on my radio program, a caller will kid around about all the money I make and say something like, "Hey, send me some of that." And I say, "You wouldn't take it, would you?" Usually that rates a pause on the line. The caller is thinking about something that he or she hasn't heard before. Well, why wouldn't I take it? The answer again is simple. If you earn it, it'll mean a lot more than if it's given to you. Taking stuff makes you weaker. Earning stuff makes you stronger. That's right, Jack. One of my favorite actors is Jack Nicholson, a true American original. Even if the movie he's in is a dog, Nicholson finds a way to elevate his role. The guy is creative and daring and outrageous. So I wasn't surprised to read in Parade magazine that Nicholson made it on his own. His father abandoned him. He didn't find out until he was 37 years old that the woman he knew as his older sister was really his mother. His grandmother had pretended to be his mother. From age 11, he told Parade, "I had to make my own money working. It was an advantage because I always knew that whatever I did, I'd have to do it on my own." Even though I was lucky enough to have two loving parents, I started earning money even earlier than Nicholson. In Levittown, there were two big job opportunities for urchins: grass cutting and snow shoveling. Early on, my father had a manual lawnmower. You pushed it and the grass got cut. In the middle of a hot, humid August, this was slave labor, and few adults wanted to do it. So dopey kids did it. In 1960, I got a buck a lawn. Gathering up clippings was 50 cents extra. Then my father splurged for a power mower. The problem here, as some of you will remember, was getting the damn thing to start. You had to pull a tightly coiled starter rope with a wicked snap. Most kids were too weak to kick the thing into gear. It was maddening. Also, you had to put gas in the mower, and I usually spilled the fuel, making me a potential human torch. Sometimes my father helped me out with the mower, but often he was not around. But once up and running, the power mower was faster and far easier than the push mower. However, there always seemed to be complications with the contraption. Nevertheless, I had five lawns a week, and the cash kept me in movie and candy money, with a little left over for the good humor ice cream guy. Shoveling snow was a much better deal. Just a steel shovel and your back muscles. Two friends and I could knock off 10 driveways before lunch. A buck a driveway, plus many of the Levittown moms would throw in a mug of hot chocolate and cookies. Perks! Back then, before Al Gore caused global warming, just a jest for you far-left nuts, it snowed in New York consistently for 3 months. So from the time I was 9 to age 16, the snow economy was brilliant for me. I bought my Willie Mays model McGregor baseball glove with the snow money, and I still use that glove today. By the way, try asking most kids to shovel snow today. You'll get some interesting facial expressions. When I was 16, when it became legal to do so, I got a so-called real job at a Carvel ice cream stand. This was primo. Basically, I got paid for eating ice cream and occasionally dishing it out. Since the guy who owned the store, Frank N., was rarely around, the inmates definitely ran the asylum. We knew Frank expected a couple of $100 a day from sales, and we delivered for him. But at the same time, we were not exactly the customer-is-always-right type guys. Here's what I mean. Every couple of days, one very large woman would drive up to the Carvel stand in her fine white Cadillac. Moments later, a pudgy little kid, most likely her son, would saunter up to the service window to order ice cream. On just about every occasion, the kid would screw up the order, and the lady would then alight from the car, laying on the attitude. Sometimes she went ballistic over butterscotch.